Weird. Warm.
Welcome to Our Weird World. I'm your host, John Henson, and this week is part two of the little series we started last week, just some incredible tales of survival. This week got five more stories, stories of William Rankin, Fran Salak, Cliff Judkins, Titus Hill, and Harrison O'Keen. So let's get into it. That might be the quickest we have ever gotten into story time. No cold open, no whatever I do in that first segment there. Just getting right into it. And I mean, yeah, it's a part two. There's nothing really to set up. We had the whole setup last week. And so we are starting, or at least I guess finishing up this series with our first story here of Colonel William Rankin, who in the summer of 1959, William Rankin was flying his F-8 Crusader combat jet to Beaufort, North Carolina, at about 47,000 feet in order to avoid some late afternoon thunderstorms. He was a World War II pilot. He was a Korean War veteran. I mean, dude had seen it all. He's just, at this point, just kind of like doing whatever military veterans do, just flying planes around, doing some, you know, maintenance training missions, whatever the case is. And, you know, it's late summer. It's Beaufort, North Carolina. It's Eastern North Carolina. Lots of, you know, pop-up thunderstorms. And he's flying way above cruising altitude just to kind of get around them and just kind of do what he's doing. But just before he began his descent, the engine began to grind and moan and basically make all of those noises that you don't want your airplane to make. The jet sputtered. The needles on all of the gauges kind of just went all flippity-floppity just to kind of signify that Rankin was about to have a really bad day. And then the engine stopped and everything went quiet. And Rankin just calmly comes over the radio and he's like, power failure. And like, as if it's like no big deal. Lieutenant Herbert Nolan, who was flying a second jet in formation behind Rankin, was like, hey man, you might have to eject. And at 6 p.m., after making several attempts to restart the engine, Rankin decided that it was in his best interest to continue falling out of the sky, but to do so without being inside of his airplane. And so in an instant, Rankin hit the eject button and just got catapulted into the atmosphere. The force of the ejection ripped ripped the glove off of his left hand, but otherwise everything was fine. The atmosphere, however, was not fine. The sudden change in air pressure from the cockpit of his plane to the air caused blood to just fly out of Rankin's nose, ears, mouth, and eyes. And like, normally this wouldn't have happened. Like, the military, in the way that they prepare for things, like, knew that this could happen. And so they give, you know, it's part of the safety suits and whatever. The problem was that Rankin had conveniently elected to leave his pressure chute behind before taking off. You know, probably looking at it and just like, what could possibly go wrong? I don't need that today. But 10 seconds into his free fall, Rankin dropped directly into the thunderstorm cloud that he had been flying over. The air temperature immediately dropped to negative 60 degrees Fahrenheit. That's crazy cold. Although he should have been out of that storm in a matter of seconds, because, I mean, you're like falling through the air. You're way past terminal velocity at this point. And so, like, even going, like, it would have been really cold. It would have been a real shock to the system, but it would have only been for a couple of seconds. And so your body would not have had time to even, like, get super cold, you know. But there were a ton of, like, it was just constant updrafts in that thunderstorm. Basically, what an updraft is just these strong bursts of wind that are circulating inside of a giant storm cloud that basically keep hailstones floating and rain particles floating to where they freeze and become hailstones, and they keep getting bigger and bigger and bigger, gathering more ice until they eventually are too heavy for the updrafts to keep pushing up, and then they fall out. That's how basic meteorology, it's how a thunderstorm works. So these updrafts, though, they were strong enough that they kept pushing Rankin back up into the sky, this full-grown person. The constant rise and fall, which is crazy to think about, someone free-falling through the sky, getting pushed back up into the air, as like in the air, like, I don't know. It's the visual is insane to me. But the constant rise and fall made him the equivalent of seasick, and he threw up all over his face. So now he's already had blood shooting out of every orifice on his face. Now he's got puke all over his face. So he's looking great, and it's all frozen. The air was also so saturated with water that Rankin actually struggled to breathe, and he thought that he might actually end up drowning in midair. Like, that's how crazy the inside of a thunderstorm is. To make matters worse, the barometric pressure switch connected to his parachute was triggered prematurely, which then deployed his parachute in the middle of the storm cloud, which just further prolonged his insane roller coaster ride through this cloud. After what probably felt like an eternity, Rankin exited the storm and found himself falling into the middle of nowhere. As he spotted his landing, and as one last sign that this was just not his day, a strong gust of wind pushed Rankin away from the field, the wide open field that he was going to land in, right into a large tree, sending him head first into the trunk and kind of just entangling him in all the branches. How he was finally able to, detach himself from his parachute and subsequently the tree. And then Rankin looked down at his watch, and 40 minutes had passed since he had ejected. So, using his military survival tactics, Rankin began walking in a search pattern in hopes of finding some form of civilization. He quickly found just a small back road and started trying to flag down vehicles as they passed. Unfortunately, most of these drivers decided to pass on this hitchhiker who had basically just walked out of the woods wet and bloody with like crusty frozen vomit all over his place, which, smart move, right? People in Eastern North Carolina, they're not like these super open-minded, all-loving dum-dums out in California who just like, yeah, man, I'll just hitchhike with anybody. What's the worst that could happen? No, you get murdered, especially if you have blood and vomit all over your face. That guy's going to murder you, probably. Well, Rankin was not going to do that. Eventually, one brave driver did stop and took him to a store in the town of Ahoskie, where he was able to phone the military for help. In the end, William Rankin ended up dying, but it was 50 years later. His only injuries from this actual fall was a case of superficial frostbite and decompression shock. Because dude's clearly a superhero. Like, you don't flail around in a giant thunderstorm usually and live, much less have, relatively minor injuries. And he actually returned to full duty a few weeks later and lived out the rest of his life. Our next story here is of Frane Salak, who was a Croatian music teacher who spent the first 32 years of his life just living a normal, peaceful existence. And then in 1962, the universe decided that it wanted him dead. And, this isn't anything out of order. Like, the universe wants people dead all of the time. And the universe usually has a very high first-time success rate. Like, when the universe decides it's your time to die, you pretty much end up going at that moment. All right. So it started in January of 1962 when Frane was riding in a train through a Croatian canyon on a cold, rainy day, when the train just inexplicably flipped off the tracks and crashed into the icy river at the bottom of the gorge. Train was among several people who were pulled to safety, but 17 others died in the crash. Frayne, however, walked away from the wreckage with nothing more than a broken arm and just a small case of hypothermia. The next year, 1963, Frayne decided to take the safety of airplanes rather than the train for his next journey. That plane crashed, killing 19 people. Frayne, as the plane was going down, was sucked out of the fuselage in midair when the door malfunctioned. But then rather than just getting splattered across the Croatian countryside, dude falls into a giant haystack completely unharmed. That's crazy luck. All right. Cause like bad enough that your plane just decides to disintegrate in midair and you're falling, free falling. Anyway. And like, I don't know what the Croatian countryside looks like. Probably some farmland, but like, how do you not only find a giant hay bale or haystack, but then also like, cause you have to control your fall enough, I would think, unless you're just really just eyes closed, just waiting for that final hit and then you die. But no, dude just lands in a giant haystack completely unharmed. All right. In 1966, so he takes 3 years off now. Frayne returned to regular transportation this time and took a bus, which then promptly ran off the road and crashed into a river. 4 people drowned in the accident, but Frayne swam to shore without any major injuries. 4 years later, in 1970, Frayne decides to stop letting other people transport him around because that wasn't working out for him. So he gets into a car and he starts driving, except this time the car catches fire and the fuel tank explodes just before or just after Frayne like got out and got a safe distance away. Despite the fact that all of these forms of transportation were clearly out to get him, Frayne he had to get around somehow. So in 1973, his own car again tried to kill him when his fuel pump malfunctioned, spitting hot oil onto the engine, which then sent flames shooting from the air vents into the actual car, which is like, that's not what you want to see when you're driving. You don't want to see flames shooting out of the vents that the air condition, the nice, cool, comforting air conditioning is supposed to be coming out of. And it burned, like the flames were so big and intense that it burned all of the hair off of Frayne's head. But for the next 22 years, Frayne, that was it. All right. He lived a pretty peaceful life. The universe has decided to retreat and maybe kind of draw up plan, I don't know, F at this point, to try to kill what seems to be an otherwise unkillable human being. In 1995, Frayne was walking around the Croatian capital of Zagreb when he got hit by a bus. He was hit by a bus. Surely that's the end of the story, right? Mm-mm. Nope. Frayne just walked away. Dude is like, he's invincible. The next year, Frayne was then driving along a narrow mountain road when a United Nations truck swung wide around a blind curb or a blind curve. At this point, Frayne was destined for a head-on collision. But instead, at the last moment, he jerked his car into the guardrail, which obviously we know guardrails on very steep, narrow, winding mountain roads, super safe. No, they're just for show. Frayne was immediately ejected from his car because he wasn't wearing a seatbelt. And honestly, do you blame him? Like, nothing's going to kill him at this point. And even if he probably was wearing a seatbelt, that would actually probably make his attempt to get out to safety even more difficult. So he was ejected from his car and he watched as his car then plummeted 300 feet into the gorge below while he is hanging for dear life on the branch of a tree on the side of this mountain. Like, that's cartoonish level of like, cause like I've seen so many different shows do that same thing. They're driving along a mountain road, car veers off the side, plummets down into the gorge below. And they're just sitting there hanging on like this one random branch that's poking out of the mountain. That is this dude's literal life right now. And if he had been wearing his seatbelt, dude's dead, 100%. But no, he's not wearing a seatbelt, and he's eventually rescued. After seven attempts to kill Francelok, the universe just finally gave up. And because the universe is a good sport about these sorts of things, it actually ended up rewarding Frayn for all of the hell that it had put him through. Because in 2003, just 2 days after his 73rd birthday, Francelok won $1 million in the lottery. After seven insane near-death experiences, dude wins $1 million in the lottery, which he used to buy two houses and a boat, and then he gave the rest of the money to friends and family. So good on him, man. I don't know if he's still alive. Probably not. If he was 73 in 2003, I mean, he could be. He's pushing 90 right now. Maybe he's still alive and just kicking it. Our next story here is of Cliff Judkins, who on June 21st, 1963, was flying an F-8 Crusader jet, just like the one that William Rankin was flying in our first story. So you know how this one's going to go. It's pretty similar. Rather than being in North Carolina, though, Cliff was flying from California to Hawaii. And so these F-8 Crusaders, they're relatively small jets. And so they don't have enough fuel capacity to make it from California to Hawaii. And so Cliff had to refuel over the Pacific Ocean. And during the refueling operation, the fuel pipe from the tanker malfunctioned and set Cliff's plane on fire. Cliff had to act quickly before his plane like fully exploded. And so, you know, luckily for him, right? American government, the military, they have everything in place just in case things like this happen. The problem was that this was the 1960s, and a lot of these safety features were about as reliable as the actual planes themselves. Cliff hit the first eject button, but nothing happened, which is not what's supposed to happen. You hit the eject button, you're supposed to eject. But that's fine. There's a plan in place for this. Cliff reached down and pulled the backup ejection lever, and still nothing happened. So rather than burn up in this plane that's about to explode, Cliff decided he was going to be a superhero and survive despite flying at 20,000 feet. He punched the roof of the cockpit open, which I don't know, man. Like, I feel like if you're in a fighter jet that can go almost faster than the speed of sound, you shouldn't be able to just easily punch the glass roof open. And then he stood up and then just let the pressure from, you know, the air outside suck him out of the burning plane. So thinking he was relatively safe at this point, Cliff decided to deploy his parachute and just float softly back down to Earth, gently land in the ocean without any further incident. But that's, of course, like, no, that's not what happened, right? So as Cliff was falling at over 250 miles an hour, he deployed his parachute and quickly realized that, like, he was not slowing down. And he looked up to find that his main parachute was tangled in its own cords. And so he, like, you know, he's looking up at it. You know, he's probably like, well, this is not good. Especially considering that I'm about to hit the water, which is what he did. Full speed. All right. He smacks the ocean real fast. All right. And just immediately vaporized, like just turned into a pile of human chum ready for the sharks, right? No, of course not. That's not what happened. By the time Cliff like came to his senses underwater, he's several feet underwater, his parachute had actually finally decided to fully deploy, become untangled, and now was actually pulling him down to the ocean floor. So underwater, he's just hit the water at hundreds of miles an hour. He pulls out a small knife from his chest pockets, cuts the parachute lines, and then just floats back up to the surface. A rescue plane spots him immediately, which is like the only good thing that happened in this entire story. And the rescue plane drops a life raft in his vicinity. But here's the thing. Cliff has two broken ankles, a broken hip, a broken vertebra, and a partially collapsed lung. His kidneys and his intestines are in critical failure right now because of how hard he has hit the water. He's cut up, he's bruised, and so he couldn't actually climb on board the raft. He was somehow able to swim to it. So he just kind of like held on to the raft and just kind of bobbed around the middle of the ocean for the next 2.5 hours before he was finally rescued, which is nuts. And by all accounts, I think he's still alive today. All right. That's just nuts, you know, because I mean, Pacific Ocean, famously a lot of sharks there, as we've covered, I think, in the USS Indianapolis story from last year when we talked about some World War II stories, a lot of sharks. And if you are super injured, like Cliff was, probably bleeding, he was definitely bleeding internally. That blood, you know, sharks are going to smell that blood. And like, yeah, just amazing that he was actually able to survive floating in the ocean for that long, and get rescued, even like even falling out of the plane. Just, you know, whatever. Our next story here, fast forward to closer to modern times. On Thanksgiving night, 2002, Tammy Hill was driving with her three children, home from a family Thanksgiving gathering. Titus, who was her 7-year-old son, had just finished up a phone call with his father and was trying to hand the phone back to Tammy. So they're flying down the highway. Tammy couldn't reach the phone, so she unbuckles her seatbelt to then kind of turn back to the back seat of the car to give herself some more leverage. Unsurprisingly, though, I think what happened was she turned her whole body and then turned the steering wheel with her rather than like keeping her arm, like her steering arm straight. And so Tammy lost control of the car and rolled it twice before then being launched out of the driver's seat into the pitch black night. At that point, Titus sprang into action because he wasn't just like some little pansy who was just going to sit there and cry like his siblings were doing. He checked on his two sisters, who were 2 and 4 years old, and after feeling pretty confident that they weren't dead, and they weren't, he crawled out of the mangled car and went to go find his mother. After searching for a few minutes, kind of completely ignoring his pre-existing fear of all things dark, Titus decided to run in his socks and pajamas in freezing temperatures out in the middle of Colorado. For a half mile to a nearby farm where he then crawled under an electric fence and found someone to call for help. Once everyone was rescued, Titus was hailed as a hero and even held a press conference for this because, like, even back in 2002, people were just shocked that millennials were capable of such things. And I wish I could find the audio from this press conference because it's a hoot. But like I've got some of the transcript, like one reporter, like this is just such, this is why I hate journalism and why I dropped out of it in college. One reporter asked what lesson Titus had learned from the incident, because of course that's the kind of stupid question, empty, soulless question that you ask. And Titus, to his account, he said nothing. He said he didn't learn anything from it. And then another reporter who did not learn the lesson from the first reporter asked Titus what it felt like when the car rolled over. And my guy, I love it. He said, it felt like a car rolling over. Yes, I love this kid. I love this kid. And then another reporter, who was apparently oblivious to the first two dumb questions that were asked, asked Titus what his feet felt like on the freezing ground. Kind of cold, is exactly what he said. Like, I mean, just... The real takeaway from this story is not that this 7-year-old kid ran a half mile in freezing temperatures and saved his family. It's the fact that journalists are so lazy at their job and they're just looking for easy quotes to fill space. Like, you're going to ask, what lesson did you learn from this accident? Oh, what did it feel like when the car rolled over? Oh, what did your feet feel like on the freezing ground? Like, these are stupid questions. They're stupid, stupid questions. It's why I hate sports reporting Like every sports press conference, I'm going to derail the show right now. Every sports press conference is just the same empty, soulless questions. Like, you don't need to ask, because the players don't care. Like, the players just came, they lost a game. And it's like, oh, man, it looks like, you know, you guys got out-rebounded tonight. What happened out there? I mean, like, what are you supposed to say to that? Yeah, they got the ball more than we did. Yeah. Like, as much as I don't like Bill Belichick as a person, I love that he does not play this game with reporters. Like, his press conferences are hilarious because, like, he exposes how stupid their questions are. Anyway, I don't know. That's probably the biggest regret I have about not being a professional athlete, is because that's how I would be in press conferences. I don't understand why you think that sort of question is going to give you the response you need to give you the valuable information that you need that you couldn't have already just come to yourself. Anyway, our last story here is of Harrison O'Keen, who was a happy, healthy Nigerian cook working for a Chevron tugboat out in the Atlantic. To make things better, Harrison was even about to get married. And the only thing that stood between him and just a life full of happiness with his bride was one last assignment out here on this tugboat. In the early morning hours of May 26th, I think this is 2002, 2004, something like that. Harrison was taking a late night pee when the ship was overtaken by a sudden ocean swell that capsized the boat. Before long, this tugboat was 100 feet beneath the surface of the water. And O'Keen, who was wearing nothing but his boxer shorts, jumped out of the bathroom in time to watch three of his shipmates get sucked through an emergency escape hatch into the turbulent waters. And they're dead. He decided that probably wasn't the best way out and waded through the dark corridors that were quickly filling up with very, very cold water. He somehow found a pantry and grabbed a few cokes and a few tools and then found his way to a relatively dry portion of the ship and just kind of waited to die, which is kind of what you do when life chooses to just kind of torture you and just not outright kill you on the spot. Because, I mean, look, this boat is way underwater. This boat has sunk. It's 100 feet below the surface. And he's just watched two people get ripped out of the boat, out of the escape hatch, and drown immediately. So it's like, what are you going to do? Because the boat's not going to float back up to the surface. That's not how boats work. And so he spent the rest of the night in basically a 4-foot pocket of air. And he, you know, as the water continued to rise in his room, he kept stacking mattresses on the ground to keep as dry as he possibly could. Within a couple of hours, he found out that sharks and barracudas had actually gotten inside the boat and were tearing at the remains of some of the other shipmates who didn't make it out. Time was running out, and with every breath he took, he knew that he was losing oxygen in the room, and so he figured he would be dead by morning. But then science happened. Thanks to this little thing called Boyle's Law, which we all know what that is, but for those of you who don't, I'll explain it. Boyle's Law states that when atmospheric pressure increases, gases present in the atmosphere become more dense. And so basically what that meant in O'Keen's case was that there was way more oxygen in his little pocket of air than he thought there would be, because the water was basically taking all of the air molecules and compressing them down into this dry space. Even more, all of the carbon dioxide that he was exhaling was actually being absorbed by the freezing cold water, which allowed him to sit by himself in this tiny little dry spot of this sunken ship for 62 hours. So, on the one hand, a miracle that he survived that long. Gotta be the most horrifying, nerve-wracking, nightmarish 62 hours ever, right? Because it's like, you just assume you're going to die. You know how you're going to die. You're going to drown or suffocate to death. Neither of which is great. or you're going to get attacked and killed by a shark. Like, none of those options are great. And it's just a matter of when, not if, right? But Chevron, they were very aware that one of their tugboats had sunk, and they sent a rescue team out to retrieve the boat because, like, they weren't in, like, a huge rush because they figured everyone on board was dead. And O'Keen, he sees this rescue diver peering in through a window, and so he grabs a hammer and just starts pounding on the ship's walls, which has got to be, like, that's got to give the diver a heart attack because the diver's thinking he's not going to see anyone alive. And then all of a sudden he sees this guy banging on the walls with a hammer trying to get his attention. Is he a zombie? Maybe. But because, like, you don't expect anyone that far down to be alive. No way. But Harrison O'Keen, he got rescued, even though he had to spend another 60 hours in a decompression chamber to get rid of all the nitrogen that had built up in his system. But eventually he was released and he returned to a normal life. I don't know if he ended up getting married or not. Because I think, you know, I don't know if his recovery, like, coincided, like, cause he was, like, about to get married. So I don't know if he ended up getting married. Like, it was an African news story. So, like, I don't know, you know, they don't do a good job of following up, but, yeah, those are today's stories. So there you go. 10 stories of survival over the last couple of weeks. Just nuts. Absolutely nuts. None of those people should have lived as long as they did, but they did. And so let's see what we learned today.
What did we learn?
Number one, F-8 Crusader jets. I don't think they're in use anymore, and probably for good reason, because they clearly were not reliable. Number two, Frayn Salak, clearly indestructible, and the universe tried, couldn't do it, and so it gave him $1 million for surviving. Number three, thanks to Boyle's Law, if you ever find yourself in a sinking ship, find a dry area, a closed-in area, because that's where all the air molecules are going to go, and you're going to be able to survive, and hopefully someone decides to rescue you. Otherwise, that's going to be a really slow, long death. Next week on Our Weird World, we're doing another two-part series, this time on some pretty silly assassins. These are people who were out to kill someone very prominent, and they were not very good at it. I mean, like, in some ways they were successful, but they really struggled to make it. So next week we are looking at three stories of some presidential assassins. So we are looking at the stories of Richard Lawrence, Giuseppe Zangara, and John Schrank. And so, attempted assassinations that I think one of these was successful, but we'll look at these stories, just how silly and unhinged these people were. And so that'll be a fun time for everybody. So thank you for listening. That's going to be it. Keep telling all your friends and keep it weird.